It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Vultures, cranes, herons, eagles. It is springtime in Iowa and big birds are on the move. Wildlife biologist Jim Peace is here and we're going to talk about some of these big birds this hour. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Charity.
But we are going to start the hour with some very exciting news about some big birds that are not on the move right now. Eagles that have a nest.
They've already moved in.
That's right, right here in Iowa. Many of you, of course, have heard about the Eagle Cam from Decora with the Raptor Resource Project. Many of you have watched the Eagle Cam. And with me now is John Howe, the director of the Raptor Resource Project. And they had big news this morning. Of course, we've been on Hatch Watch. Hello, John.
Hey, good morning, Charity. Good
Welcome
morning,
back to the show.
Yeah.
All right. We've been watching those eggs very closely, and there is big news in your north nest today. Tell me what's going on.
Right. So overnight, everybody's been watching very closely, but we thought we had something earlier in the day, but late in the evening, one of our watchers, Sherry, noticed a star-shaped crack. And we see that happen a lot, a star-shaped crack in one of the eggs where that eaglet with the egg tooth is pushing from the inside and breaking that first hole through the egg. So that was noticed, and I think we saw something that looked a little bit larger in a photo capture here this morning. So that's the big news. That's what's going on. We got the first hatch in progress here.
Wow. Well, and coming out of an egg is incredibly hard work. How long before we expect to actually see that eaglet emerge?
That probably, it could be as early as later on today, but it could be as late as tomorrow. That process really is one of those things that is laborsome for that eaglet that's trying to get out. So it depends, but it could be later today, maybe later in the night, and possibly into the wee hours of the night and early tomorrow morning.
Now, I mentioned this is in the north nest.
Right.
Tell me about the north nest.
So the north nest, that's eagle nest up in oak tree, and that's we usually talk about how this is one of the largest nests that we've watched, almost probably 10 and a half feet in diameter right now. But that nest is pretty much right on schedule just about with the fish hatchery. The Decora eagles that most everybody knows down at the fish hatchery at south of Decora, they laid their egg at the north nest, the first egg, a day before the Decora eagles at the fish hatchery did. So they're pretty close in their scheduling. They both are, the mom and dad are sitting on three eggs at both nests. And the one thing that's kind of interesting here that we're talking about this with the north nest is we can actually see the eggs at the north nest. At the fish hatchery, or Decora eagles there, they've got that nest cup dug so deep that even with the camera angles that we've got, we really can't see much other than just the top of the eggs recently here. So they're being a little bit more protective of letting anybody see those eggs, building that wall up there.
Well, and John, I love to check in on the eagles before the hatch actually happens. You get to see the male eagle and the female eagle taking turns, watch them endure some amazing weather with snow on their backs while they incubate these eggs. But once the eagles start to hatch, then, of course, there's a lot of action. What will we be seeing in the next week or so?
Yeah, so there's just roughly 3 days apart, typically, maybe even a little bit longer than that, between the eggs hatching, typically. And as they come out, it takes several hours to half a day, but we'll see the fuzzy, down of the eaglet show up, and they're kind of weak at first, and they pop their heads up, and we'll see some of that first feeding, and it is pretty amazing. Both of the male eagles we've seen, especially at the fish hatchery, our Decora eagles, they just seem to, we call it stocking the fridge. The fish will start appearing in the nest, and then the first tender feedings of those little bitty pieces of fish or whatever prey is brought up to that eagle at first. I'd say this is probably the most watched and sought after time to watch the eagles in their life cycle.
And you mentioned the male eagle stalking the fridge. Is that how the work breaks down? Do the males go out and bring the food back?
Yeah, with raptors, with what I've seen with, and I'm sure Jim, you could mention about this too. But with falcons, it is a food relationship a lot there. But yeah, the male tends to do a lot of the food delivery and stocking, although he's also incubating and giving breaks and time to the female to get off the nest and fly around and get out and about. So it's a partnership there, but it seems like that first big drop of food we've been seeing usually is coming in from the male.
And I know you've had tremendous success with the eagles, obviously some tragedies as well in the last few years, but three eggs in each nest, how likely is it that all three of those eggs will hatch?
Well, based on our history at the fish hatchery, last year was the first year that we didn't have one of all three eggs hatch, and I think we have mentioned this with viewers once before that we did identify that egg had not been fertilized, so it wasn't something where in development something happened. So if everything went as expected and based on all the years that we've been tracking that pair of eagles, the stats would show that we're going to have three healthy eaglets hatching here at Decorah. So we have fewer years of watching just last year with the North Nest, but all three hatched last year. So there again, the statistics would with not many years under our belt there, but would indicate that we're probably going to get three also.
And you mentioned that those eggs emerge about 3 days apart, so the eaglets are staggered. They don't all hatch right at the same time. How do the younger eaglets fare with their older, stronger companions?
You know, that's an interesting thing to watch, and we've found out that, you know, and research has showed in the past that there's a number of factors that can lead to the success of multiple eaglets, you know, competing for food and things like that. But we did see a big difference in the behaviors at the two different nests last year just because of the abundance or availability of food. So we did notice in the North Nest where we had a little bit more of a scarcity of food, if you want to call it that, kind of a pecking order that developed and a little bit more aggressive behaviors there, as opposed to, we really haven't seen that down at the fish hatchery.
And, where there's and so much food.
So many fish. Yep, all those trout there.
All right. Well, John, thank you so much. So you've got the hatch going on already at the North Nest. We'll be watching for those two other eggs to hatch in the very near future. And the main nest at the fish hatchery, we could probably see a hatch this week, right?
Yes. Yeah, we'll be watching very closely.
John, I've got one question here, and that was regarding the, I remember seeing, checking into some eagle cam, and I think it was a Decorah one back in January, and they were straightening up the nest and adding to it. When did they actually start nesting, starting to think about laying eggs? So the eggs have been under incubation for about, 30 days now? And,
right.
Yeah.
Right.
So they started laying then about 5 weeks ago. Is that correct?
Yeah. I'm just going to give you. So at the North Nest, we had our first egg laid on the 19th of February.
Okay.
And that was later in the day. And then at the fish hatchery, it was on the 20th. So about a day apart, but pretty darn close there.
Right. Yeah.
So yeah, right, kind of later in February is when the first eggs were laid.
Yeah, it always seems amazing, of course. Of course, we have in Iowa we have great horned owls nesting in laying eggs in January and early February
right.
as well. So it always amazes people. They're why are they doing it so early? And from eagles, it makes good sense because there's a lot of prey available then for a longer period of time for those young ones to develop and get up to full size. So that's
right.
That's
and we did see those great horned owls doing some nest shopping down at the fish hatchery earlier this year, and they didn't show up during the daytime, but in past years we've seen great horned owls come in and make a strike at the adults when they're on the nest at night. So hopefully we don't see too much of that kind of thing. We
right.
don't want to see any injuries there or any disturbances, but they are definitely very beautiful raptors. We love the great horned owls, too.
Well, and it does reinforce just how amazing their abilities to keep those eggs warm is. I mean, they're out there incubating eggs at the time of year when I have a hard time staying warm walking from the car to the house.
Oh, and we had a lot of people cringing, including myself, just watching the winds and the snow and the sleet and the cold there, and they do such a great job keeping those eggs incubated and warm. So very good job there.
Well, John, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Yeah, you're welcome.
John Howe is the executive director of the Raptor Resource Project. And, of course, if you go to raptorresource.org, you can see these nests for yourself. Millions of people have been watching the Decorah Eagles for years now. There's the main nest at the fish hatchery. We're expecting a hatch there later this week. There's the north nest where there's a hatch underway already. You can also follow along on Facebook as well. And Jim, we're going to take a break here in a moment, but then we're going to talk about birds that are on the move this time of year.
You bet.
All right. Jim Pease, wildlife biologist. You're also welcome to join our conversation this hour. We're going to talk more about eagles and turkey vultures and sandhill cranes and great blue herons. We'd love to hear from you as well. You can give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With us this hour, Jim Pease, wildlife biologist. We're talking about big birds this hour. And, of course, we started off with that exciting news from Decorah with a hatch underway at the Decorah North Nest. You can find out more at raptorresource.org. But, Jim, a lot of birds are also on the move this time of year. And we see a lot of eagles out and about, the ones that aren't sitting on nests. So where are they going? And
yeah.
Why aren't they sitting on nests?
We, of course, have lots of eagles around in Iowa during the winter. Traditionally, we've had as many as 4,000 or so that have overwintered here. These are northern birds. You can tell by their Canadian accents that they come down from the north, and they spend the winter with us because we have such balmy weather, certainly by comparison to across Canada. And so they've headed back north, and we still see some coming from places further south, heading north. But a lot of them have already left. We had such a weird winter. It was hard to know where winter began or winter ended and spring began. But if you didn't notice it by the temperatures, you certainly have noticed it by the birds. My wife and I took a trip the last couple of weeks out to Vermont and back to see our granddaughter play in a state basketball tournament. And in the process of driving across the country, I think anybody who is sort of aware of their surroundings and not just the road in front of them notices the birds, big flocks of birds going over, and especially big birds. You really notice it, even if you're driving 70 miles an hour, you can't help but notice, I think, some of these, at least I can't.
So the eagles are headed back north?
Yeah, Yeah, they're headed back north.
And, it's just gotten too warm for them here.
Yeah, well it's as we just learned in the first part of the hour, they begin nesting, thinking about nesting in January even, and those were laid mid to late February. They were laying eggs here in Iowa. Well, the same is true farther north. They want to get up there just as soon as they can. But they have to time it so that they can still, so that there's ice. If there's too much ice on the rivers and lakes, they can't find food except by scavenging of along the roadways and stuff. So they have to time it. So some are still heading north because there are places across, particularly across Canada, where in the boreal forest where the ice is still on the lakes, and so they can't find fish.
So will the birds that return that far north, will they nest up there?
Yes, yeah. They'll certainly nest across the boreal forest and clear
up. They'll just start later.
Yeah. Just start later and maybe end a little later, come south a little later as things begin to freeze up in the late fall. They will certainly, again, the timing is everything, and some birds hedge their bets a little bit and go a little bit earlier and maybe find their nest already occupied, or they discover, gee, there's really not much, there's no open water here, so I'm going to have to go back farther south, and so they'll kind of time that a little bit and try to be there at the right time.
Well, one of my favorite things about the Raptor Resource Project and the Decora Eagle Cam is that, of course, we've gotten this up close and personal view of eagles with their nesting behavior,
right,
with their parenting behavior. But it also helps us learn a lot about these birds, because I think that there are still a lot of misconceptions about bald eagles. And one of the most interesting misconceptions is about what bald eagles sound like.
Yeah.
And give us a little bit of background on this. This is not our fault that we don't know what bald eagles sound like,
no,
right?
It is the fault of advertisers and movie makers, because they like this great big national symbol to have a screaming call. And we still see it on ads today. But they don't have a screaming call. What they use instead of the real eagle call is usually the scream of a red-tailed hawk on lots of movies. And I've just seen recent ads, in fact, for Subaru or something that they see this eagle coming across the stream, and you hear the scream of a red-tailed hawk. But no, they sound very chicken-like. Have you got?
Well, I do. First, I want to start with kind of a tweeting sound, which I love to hear, but it,
right,
you know, it sounds a little incongruent coming out of this big, amazing bird. So let's listen a little bit to what I would call tweeting.
That's pretty typical.
Right. Okay. And then here's a little bit different. It's a little squawkier. Here we go.
Isn't it amazing? You know,
it is.
This great, and that's why they don't use it on the ads and in the movies, because it sounds so chicken-like. Really, it's just amazing. But and they fool us. So it's not our fault. But that's actually a bald eagle, our national symbol. And this is a bird that has a body length of about 31 inches. This is a big bird, and they weigh 9 to 10 pounds. And their wingspan, when they spread those wings out, it's 6 to 7 feet, depending on the gender of the bird and the age and everything. But you're talking a really big bird here. And to tell them from other birds, and you say, well, gee, how can you tell that going down the highway at 70 miles an hour, you know, did you see the white head? Well, sometimes on adult birds, you do see that white head and the white tail. And in cloudy weather like we have today, it'll sometimes look like the head and tail are missing, and you're just seeing the dark underside of this adult bird. But what you look for is when they're soaring, those wings are absolutely horizontal. They're flat. They're even out on each side, as opposed to birds that have their wings up in a V, and we'll talk about another one of those later. So they soar with their wings out on the horizontal, but they don't soar as much as some other birds. They have pretty heavy wing beats, and they don't push them as deeply into the wind.
And you mentioned the white head, but we see a lot of juvenile bald
right.
eagles, and I think there's a lot of confusion about just what those are when people
yeah.
see
oh,
them.
Oh, there are, yeah, because they vary. The juveniles, they don't get that white head and tail until year five, so they're not mature until they're 5 years old. And so they vary from sort of an all-brown body when they're in their first year to – and head and tail are brown as well. To each year, they get more or less more mottling of white and brown, even on their chests and back and everything. There's a lot of mottling. And it's difficult, unless you really study them, to tell the difference between a 2-year-old, a 3-year-old, and a 4-year-old. You have to really look at the patterning of the because there is a pattern that they gradually get that whiteness. But there's a lot of mottling, and they get mistaken for other birds as well. But so you've got when you have a lot of nests, and Iowa is very, very fortunate. We have over 300 known nests in the state. We've got lots of juveniles, and when they're around, it can be very confusing them with other hawks and other eagles, including things like ospreys, for example. They get frequently mistaken because of the mottling. But look for that horizontal wing beat, and the size of the bird is so big. It's really it's pretty incredible.
So if they make you really catch your breath. It's a good chance.
Yeah,
it's a bald eagle.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I've been around some younger kids recently that have they're taking it for granted because they've always seen eagles. And your kids, for example, I'm sure they've seen them a lot. And for us who went through a period in which eagles were a rarity to see, and now we have, 300 nests in Iowa. My golly, I can see why they do take them for granted. But, boy, we've got to make sure that we don't take that for granted.
I still get excited every single
time. I do, too.
So, now, you mentioned some other big birds that we see. And there's a bird out there that a lot of people mistake for an eagle when they just glance at it. And then if they find out what it is, they may be a little disappointed. But they're still really cool birds. You mentioned that deeper V. Tell us who you're talking about.
The turkey vulture. This is a bird that also has a very large wingspan, 5 to 6 feet, almost as big as an eagle. Their body is 26 inches long, but they only weigh 4 pounds. There's a lot of feathers there, for carrying this this 4-pound bird. And their wings, when they fly, in fact, I saw coming into the studio this morning, I saw three because they tend to be late risers in the morning.
They like the warmth,
they
right?
They do. They like the warmth, and they like the fact once the sun comes up, if we see the sun today, it creates these rising warm air currents that they tend to ride on. They don't like to expend a lot of energy. They're not lazy. They're just efficient, and so they'll ride these thermals, not flapping their wings at all. And their wings, instead of being on the horizontal, straight across, flat, if you will, like the eagles when they soar. They are up in a V, slightly off the horizontal. You look at them kind of as they bank and turn, and they're up in a V, V for vulture, if you will. so they can, and it appears like they're really flying very effortlessly, and in fact they are. They make use of those rising air currents and wind. You see them tipping in the wind back and forth, and the wind can make it difficult for them, but it keeps them aloft, and that's they're very skilled pilots at staying aloft even in pretty strong winds.
And I've been told that you can tell it's a turkey vulture, not just from their behavior, that's circling, that mm-hmm. riding the thermals, but because their wingtips look fringed.
Yeah.
You can see in between their feathers.
Yeah, oftentimes. But other birds will do that, too. That's not a perfect way of doing it. Those primary feathers spread out and look like fingers often when they're soaring. And that's not a perfect sign because it depends on the wind. It depends on all sorts of things. But they spread those fingers, those primary feathers out to adjust, if you will, their flying ability, their soaring ability in particular, under different wind and thermal conditions. So it's not a perfect way to tell. The other way to tell, of course, you're talking about a big bird. It looks very dark. It looks black to us, but they're really sort of a dark brown and black mix if you look at them up close and personal. And they have a very small head. The head looks small because it, of course, with vultures, has no feathers on it. Sometimes, in certain light, you can see, and depending if you've got a good, strong pair of binoculars or anything, don't do this while you're driving. you can see the red head of the turkey vulture. And the other thing to look for is what the body looks like underneath. And the body itself is black, but the wings, the leading edge is dark, is black. But the primary and the secondary feathers, in other words, the trailing edge of the wings, look gray all the way across and to the body. And so you look for that sort of pattern, not only the dihedral, the V, if you will, for vulture that is they soar with, but also that sort of gray two-tone pattern to their wing feathers.
And now, sometimes you're lucky enough to see them on the ground, and I know that a lot of people are kind of icked out by vultures. I think a lot of people are scared of vultures. They're not waiting for you to die.
Right. But I often say, I'm not dead yet.
Vultures are doing us a huge service, right?
Yeah, absolutely. They are the garbage collectors, the cleanup crews, if you will, of the bird world, of the animal world. They're scavengers. And almost exclusively scavengers. So they're soaring around looking for dead stuff. And they, unlike most birds, have a very keen sense of smell. And they can smell the what bodies, dead bodies, give off a gas called mercaptan. And they can smell that from quite a distance, actually. So they have a very keen sense of smell. And
what they eat, it's hard to imagine that they have a keen sense of smell, because they seem to prefer something that's been dead longer rather than
yes.
a briefer period of time. So they like their carrion to be ripe.
Yes, they like it. They'll certainly take it before it's ripe, but usually they don't get a chance at it before it's ripe because other birds and other animals are on it first. I've reminded this in Africa. There are lots more species of vultures there, and they are incredibly so. They're much larger, and they don't get their chance at it until the lions and the hyenas have finished up. Well, they don't get their chance at a pile of dead stuff until, including things like coyotes and foxes, are done with it. And bald eagles. Bald eagles, by the way, are quite good scavengers. They're opportunistic predators. They don't just eat fish. They're very good at scavenging. And you'll often see in a field where a deer may have died being hit off the road or something, this time of year you'll see an eagle feeding on the carcass, and around him in a respectful circle are the turkey vultures waiting their turn. So I'm not sure that they prefer the pretty ripe ones, but that's what they end up with.
That's what they get. All right, Jim is on the line in Spencer. He's got a turkey vulture question for you. Hi, Jim. Jim, are you there? Oh, we had him. We had him locked in. There you go. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
Hi.
Am I back?
Yeah, you are. What's your question?
I was just going to say that was interesting what Jim was saying about the turkey vultures having to wait a long time to get their chance at a carcass, because Hollywood enjoys bringing them right in when fellows are still lying on the ground breathing and going, get out of here. You know?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we get these misimpressions of lots of things from the depictions
well,
we see in the movies.
A couple things about the vulture. Now, when I see them flying, it seems like their feather tips are splayed a bit more mm-hmm. than an eagle. Another thing is, I'm very curious to know a little bit about their nesting. I never see a vulture nest. And I'm kind of wondering when they tend to come back to Iowa.
All right. So, and we're going to have to take a break here in just a moment. So do the first one, Jim. When do they start to show up again?
Well, they are back already. Many of them are back. These are birds that are coming from southern U.S. through Mexico and even Central and South America. And there's a tendency in the bird world for birds and migratory birds, for the ones that go the furthest south in the winter, go back the furthest north in the summer. So perhaps the birds that were appearing here already almost a month ago now are birds that were from the southern U.S.
All right.
We don't really know. We'll talk some more.
And yeah, Jim and Spencer will answer the rest of your questions in just a moment. Jim Peace in Ames will be back in just a moment as well. We're going to take a short break and we'll continue our conversation about some of the big birds that we see on the move in Iowa right now. Turkey vultures, sandhill cranes, if we're lucky, great blue herons and eagles. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here today. We're talking about some of the big birds on the move during the springtime. We've been talking about turkey vultures. We talked about eagles earlier in the hour. We'll also talk briefly about sandhill cranes and great blue herons. And before we move on, Jim, let's answer another one of Jim and Spencer's questions about nesting. When do turkey vultures nest and where?
Well, they nest in the late spring here in Iowa, and the ones we see back now, I was saying before the break that the ones we see back now are probably coming back up from the southern U.S., but they can migrate as far as from South America, and I was saying that there's this tendency in migratory birds for the ones, it seems strange, it seems like the ones that are in the southern U.S., they ought to go to Canada, and the ones in Central and South America ought to come to the southern U.S. or the central U.S., but it doesn't happen that way in most migratory birds. So I suspect, although I don't have any banding data that tells me one way or the other, where our birds are coming from, but most likely the ones in Iowa that spend the summers with us come from the southern U.S. Now, we do have some nesting in Iowa, but there isn't a great deal of a great number of nests, nothing compared to the numbers of birds we have around all summer long. And I'm not sure that I know why that is. It would seem that the food supply is good and solid. Like other large birds, like eagles, for example, it takes several years before they're mature enough to breed. But we do have some breeding going on in the state. They can nest like lots of other birds. Large birds, they'll make use of some rock ledges on cliffs, of very secluded areas. But they'll also make use of hollow trees and to build a nest in the hollow. So it's it appears that they're a little a little more sneaky about or secretive about where they put their nests. So it may be that there are more nesting than we know. But most of the birds we see in the summer are non-breeders, and they are actually will go to communal roosts at night, where there'll be from a dozen to several dozen birds that will roost together at night. But so we do have some nesters, but I'm not sure why we don't have more.
Now, okay, we're going to move on to sandhill cranes in just a moment, but I want to ask you about vultures because they have this amazing self-defense mechanism, and we just need to talk about it before we move on. So they look like really strong, scary birds, but they're not violent birds.
No, they're quite curious.
Right, and they have a really remarkable way of protecting themselves. So tell us about it, Jim.
Yeah, you know this as a wildlife rehabber. You have experienced
it. I have smelled
it, I'm sure.
It.
Yes. They have this ability to throw their vomit quite some distance, as a matter of fact. So when they're really threatened, they will do this projectile vomiting, and it is very effective at making you stay away if they really want to. So
it's a remarkable smell.
Yes, it is.
And I have heard amazing stories of a whole tree full of turkey vultures being frightened at the same time and responding in the same way.
Exactly. So yeah, you can tell if you are ever walking in the woods, you can tell when you're near turkey vulture roost, because there is a particular smell that is very, very pungent, we'll say. they have wonderful bacteria in their stomach, actually, which keeps them from getting any diseases from these highly decomposed things they're feeding on. So I think makes their the vomit particularly odoriferous.
All right, let's talk a little bit about sandhill cranes. We don't see a lot of them in Iowa. There are a few that visit us every year, more every year. Where do we see these birds?
Well, actually, we have an increasing number that go over the state that we do see them and hear them. And that's the thing that I think will tip people off as much as anything, because they don't sound, once you learn this sound, they don't sound like any other bird. They don't sound like snow geese or Canada geese or other flocks of birds that might go over. Have you got the sound there?
I do. I have this. This was four sandhill cranes on the ground speaking,
okay.
But
sure.
You'll get an idea.
Yeah.
Those are birds with
so
a lot
wonderful.
To say.
Yeah, it's a warble, and that warble, I think, is so. That's what tips you off often. If you're out in the woods and you hear that, you say cranes, and actually, because they fly often very high and pass over a lot of the state, a lot of people miss them until they memorize that sound. And boy, it can really tip you off to some spectacular migration, because there are these large V's of these birds. These birds migrate in flocks of up to 1,000 birds in a given flock. And they form these huge V's, and they come up in the morning. They'll roost overnight during migration, often along river ways. So Iowa being rich in rivers, we do have them here. And they will stand in the water, particularly shallow rivers. And they'll stand in the water, and they will that helps protect them, I think, a little bit from predators. And then in the morning, as they fly, they'll make that warbling sound as they go up and up and up and up. And they'll get high enough where they'll catch the wind, or the thermals are now rising out of that river valley, and they set their wings, they get in these Vs, and they'll fly down that as they fly north or south, depending on the time of year. They'll fly down that thermal for 50 or 60 miles, then find another thermal, and they'll spiral as they go back up again. It's really an amazing feat of migration, and they make that sound when they're climbing, and occasionally when they're flying over. Now, increasingly, we do have more and more sandhill cranes nesting in Iowa, and it's quite fun to see them. And the little ones are like a lot of young of great big birds. They sort of homely and gangly looking, but they once they hatch, unlike the eaglets, where they are atricial, meaning that they have to have several weeks in the nest before they're ready to fledge, to leave out of the nest. The crane young, when they get out of the nest, are precocial. So within a day of when they hatch, they're out walking around with their parents and trying to learn how to find the bugs and other things on the ground. So this is a bird that has, again, 6 to 6.5 wingspan, a body, large body, about 46 inches long from the tip of their beak to the end of their tail, and they weigh 8 to 10 pounds. So this is a very big bird. Again, that wingspan's the same size as an eagle. And most often we'll see them standing sort of in open fields, in wet spots, marshes, sometimes by the hundreds, but now we'll see them in pairs. They literally migrate in flocks of hundreds of thousands of birds, and at night they'll get together. If you have not seen the migration in through Nebraska, there's a 90-mile sort of funnel, if you will, between Grand Island and Kearney, Nebraska. If you've never seen this, make plans to go and see this wildlife spectacle. You will see anywhere from a couple of 100,000 birds to 500,000 birds on the ground at one time. This is sort of the North American equivalent of Africa's great migration of hooved animals. It's a spectacular sight to go and see them. They stage, for some reason, in this very narrow funnel, taking advantage, I think, of the riverine wetlands and the fields along the Platte River there between Grand Island and Kearney. And they feed there for several days to a couple of weeks before they move on north, and they spread out from that narrow 90 mile wide segment. They'll spread out across the northern U.S. and Canada, all the way to Alaska, and practically to the east coast of Canada. Not quite, but almost.
Wow!
It's an amazing spectacle to see. So if you
it's worth traveling.
Oh,
for.
It is. If you've never seen it, you want to at least once in your life go and see this spectacular migration. It's really incredible.
Now, I promised we'd also talk about great blue herons today, so yeah. It's going to be brief. But let's start with the voice of the great blue heron, because it's such a, we've heard a lot of unusual calls this
right.
hour. This one is equally strange.
Arr. Arr, arr,
so
arr.
Almost dog-like, almost frog-like.
Yeah. Sounds like they're angry all the time. That's right.
I've heard that a lot along rivers. I'm paddling down rivers, and I come around a corner, and I disturb when he gets up and, what are you doing here? So, yeah, they're quite spectacular. And like the cranes, this is a wingspan of 6 feet, as big as the crane is. And the body is the same as a crane. It's 46 inches long. They both have these long pointed bills, as opposed to the turkey vulture and bald eagle, of course, that have these hooked bills. Hooked bills are made for tearing apart the flesh of the thing that they're eating, whereas those long straight bills are made for probing, in the case of cranes, probing into the grasses, the tall grasses and the marshes and the fields that they feed in, and finding things below, from insects to small and other small invertebrates to small vertebrates. In the case of the great blue heron, they use that bill to dive at lightning speed into the shallow water and grab a fish or a frog that might present itself in front of them. The difference in their flight, and this is, you know, you're talking two birds the same size, they're both gray. Yes, the great blue heron has a black head, and the crane has this reddish, rusty red forehead. The difference is in how they fly. The crane flies with their wings, with their head and neck straight out in front of them, and their feet straight out behind them. So they're they look very, very long, and indeed they are. And the great blue heron flies with his neck in a very tight S. So you can see the difference immediately. They both have those long, 10, 12-inch long bills, but they use them very differently, and they fly very differently as a result.
We have this email from Ellen. She says, where do blue herons spend the winter? Their breeding colonies are amazing, which are two different topics. But
yes.
First, where do they spend the winter?
They spend the winter in the southern U.S., the Caribbean, and as far south as Central America. But for the most part, most of the birds that we have through the summer are probably overwintering along the Gulf Coast and in the Caribbean, around the Gulf, wherever there's water that they can stand in. And that's one of the other differences between the cranes and the great blue herons. Cranes will spend their winter in basically around the Gulf, but in the fields, the pastures of Texas, whereas great blue herons tend to spend it standing in the shallow waters along the Gulf and some of the rivers and ponds and lakes down there. And that's the same is true when you see them up here. You'll often see cranes in much more open fields, grassy, even pasture land sometimes, hunting for insects. Whereas great blue herons are almost always near open water, on the edges of rivers, the edges of ponds, of lakes, the shallow waters there. They hunt very differently. The great blue heron is almost statue-like. You know, they're standing there on the edge, and they tend not to move until something swims in front of them. Then it's like lightning speed. That neck just reaches right out and grabs that thing out of the water. Whereas cranes tend to kind of wander around in the field and peck at the ground much more, almost chicken-like, in their hunting strategy. So there's a difference in their behavior. But they... as your writer mentions, the colonies. Great blue herons are colonial nesters. Cranes are solitary nesters. But the colonies of herons are often in trees, sometimes as much as a mile away from water, in trees in uplands. A long way away from the river or lake, and you think, gee, why would it be that far away? But they find you'll find anywhere from a dozen to several hundred nests in trees. The nests are pretty flimsy. Hard to believe that they are quite as flimsy as they are.
Not like an eagle nest.
No. And in fact, they often get blown down over the winter months. But they are very, very good parents, and in fact, sometimes the nests get blown down during summer storms, and they end up having, if the young survive, then they have to raise them on the ground, and that can be very difficult for them. So,
before we completely run out of time, I want to put John in Manchester on the air. Hi, John. Well, I guess I don't. He wants to report on a pair of sandhill cranes nesting in town in Manchester,
oh, wow.
Which is incredibly cool. Unfortunately, we're having a lot of problems with our phone system. We are working on fixing that. So
okay.
I'll just report to you that John has seen a pair of nesting sandhill cranes in Manchester. So, Jim,
that's
there's
fantastic.
So much to see this time of year. Where do you like to go?
You
talk about seeing it while you're driving, but
yes, and I like to get out as often as I can, not only on my own land but in parkland around, along the rivers, go to the big lakes. We will soon have, very soon, within the next, I would say, couple of weeks, we'll have warblers starting to come through. There's so much going on in the springtime, but you have to be out there. So if you work during the day, get out before dinner, go take a walk, and get outside. And there is so much to see and enjoy to make enrich our lives. So you have to be out there to do it, though.
Keep your ears open and your eyes open.
Right.
And there's a lot to see. Jim Pease, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Wildlife biologist Jim Pease, he joins us every other month or so to share some of Iowa's wild creatures and wild places with us. Talk of Iowa is produced by Iowa Public Radio. Our producers are Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. You can get in touch with us anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, or tweet us @IPRTalk. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.